KFNB presents It's Your Money and Your Life. For the next hour, Richard Muzio and Joe Vecchio will educate and inform you on matters related to your financial future, your life, and your leisure. Now, with It's Your Money and Your Life, here are Richard and Joe.
Everybody, my name is Joe Vecchio, your co-host, announcer, and producer, coming to you live from KFNB Studios in Kearney Mesa. With 50,000 watts of power, we're heard not just in San Diego County, but Orange County, L.A. County, up the coast of Seattle on a good night and out to the desert. And now time to introduce the main man of the hour. He's a marathon runner extraordinaire. He's a core member of Strategic Trusted Advisors at Roundtable of San Diego. He is a CPA extraordinaire, and he's a family office advisor to many high net worth families. His name is Richard Muzio. Richard, good evening. How are you this evening?
I'm great. I am sort of like stuck in cords here, but I'm working myself. I don't know what I did.
You're too busy talking to the guests and not getting ready over here.
I plugged my headphones in, but it sort of encircled the lower half of my body, the cord did, so I'm sort of stuck here in this chair.
I know, we have a lot of cord in this studio.
Yeah, a lot of rope to hang myself on.
Hey, I just have to mention, and there are KFMB viewers out there as well as listeners, but Roberta Gonzalez, who used to do the weather here years ago, and she also did it over at Channel 10 and kind of started, got her start in San Diego, went on to Chicago and the WMAQ, the NBC station there, doing weather there, then got transferred to the West Coast up in San Fran. She's the main weather anchor at CBS, the CBS station in San Francisco. And just this week, she's been filling in vacation relief for nationally on CBS Saturday morning. So congrats to her. She's a good friend, and actually took up running herself when she was out here, and has done triathlons and marathons herself. Very accomplished runner, and very well liked, and doing a great job. So congrats to her. And then also next Saturday, an encore screening of a great documentary. You attended it yourself, Richard, and it's called Addiction Incorporated. And Dr. Victor Denoble, who is the key figure in the film, will be on hand for a Q&A afterward. He speaks to schools all over the country, some 350 to 400 speeches a year to students all over the country about the perils of tobacco and his research. He doesn't preach. He doesn't say you shouldn't. He just gives them the facts and his research on the rats and everything he did at Philip Morris, as you know. Anyway, it'll be at Lestat's West in Normal Heights next Saturday at 4 p.m. He'll be there, and I believe Nathan Fletcher and his wife will be there as well. As you know, he was a guest on this show, and he'll retell the story of his experience with a tobacco lobbyist when he was in Sacramento. And that's about all I have right now. What do you have, Richard? Anything before we go? Talk about Mary's.
She made her debut at the 15K distance today because she's training for her first half marathon ever.
Oh, my gosh.
Which is going to be on Cinco de Mayo up at Irvine Spectrum. That would be on May 5th.
Wow.
So she ran 9.3 miles in 1 hour and 30 minutes, beat about 80% of the crowd. On a real hilly course, the first 5 miles were uphill. I paced her. This thing was brutal.
Uh-huh.
I mean, the first 5 miles were uphill.
Well, that's inspiring because she really just took up. I mean, she's been watching her diet and everything else, but she's really only taken up running seriously when in the last couple of months, right?
5 weeks ago.
Well, okay.
Yeah. Already has one gold medal to her name. So.
And she runs this the store that she has is what called the Brighter Side
in Solana Beach, boutique for women with cancer.
Yeah, so she's doing great work, and congrats to Mary.
Yeah, so I paced her today because I've got a sore ankle, so I wasn't going to be able to run quite as fast as I want. So I told her, we'll get you in at a 1:30.
Ah, so you were her.
And so I did. I was the pace car.
You were, okay. So she just ran in your wake, I guess, right?
Or yeah, but it was a funny course because it started at Petco Park and finished at Petco, but it headed out towards North Park, which of course is a nice steady climb,
mm-hmm.
and then back down through the park. So,
hey, speaking of Petco, are the Padres going to be on Time Warner this year? What's going on with that?
I have no idea.
I mean, that's sad that we can't get our baseball.
Opening day is about 1 week away.
Yeah, I hope they get that ironed out. I mean,
we'll see.
Yeah, yeah.
We'll see.
Anyway.
They've got half the team on the disabled list. So.
Well, maybe they need another year off of the tube then. Who knows?
I saw they just released the one pitcher that they picked up in the offseason. That's how good he was.
Well, we'll have to get Mitrovic on or our friend Jerry Gross and get some of their feedback or analysis and see.
I saw Jerry Gross on Thursday at Star. Was that Wednesday? That was Wednesday at Star because our good friend Gene Locklear was the speaker.
Ah, That's great.
So that was a lot of fun.
Good, 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 good. Anyway, how about we get into the show?
Why not? Because I don't want to talk about the Aztecs.
We have a very important guest with us.
Carl Sheeler, welcome.
Yes. Good evening, Carl.
Thank you.
You want to tell people who Carl is? Or
no, he can tell. Carl, who are you? Besides being one of the sponsors of this great show.
Like Richard, I'm a core or a board member of STAR, Strategic Trusted Advisor Roundtable, and also have had the honor of being the steward for Business Valuations, Limited Allison Appraisals and Assessments for the last 20 years. We're a firm that's just now about celebrated 60 years as a San Diego fixture for providing business valuations, not just locally, but nationally.
Hmm. And the website. Let's give the website.
Yeah, give everybody your contact information so everybody knows right off the bat how to find you.
Sure, I'd be fine. Again, my name is Carl Sheeler, and our website is www.biz, V as in Victor, ALS, LTD.com. Or if you'd like to call us, 1-800-286-6635. If you want to talk to me directly, extension 211.
There you go. BizValesLimited.com. So,
and Carl, as a lead into what I really want to talk about, you did something really interesting on Friday, which is you presented at the Southern California Institute. And you had a really interesting title to your presentation. And I want you to explain what this means.
Oh, I'd be happy.
But the title was Planning and Maintenance Programs Through Attorneys That Increase Value. You were speaking to a group of, I think, 50 or 60 or 70 attorneys, primarily.
Correct. The idea is that, in most cases, the attorneys that work with the affluent and business owners tend to focus on the valuator as the last effort to assist the client, usually in minimizing the value of the equity so that they can transfer some of the wealth out of the estate. The inverse of that is the enhancing the value of the entity or the asset, in this case, mostly operating businesses, and that's something that tends to kind of fall to the wayside. And what we were trying to demonstrate that it was truly a win-win-win situation, that they could enhance the value of the operating business by bringing in some of the other collaborative advisors, enhance their own client retention, and have real skin in the game, because now they're talking about wealth as being more than just how do we increase value, but also how do we define what wealth means to the family.
And why would attorneys who do estate planning want to do this, other than the obvious inherent benefits that it's good for their client, but out of their own self-interest, why would they want to do this?
Well, there's two reasons. One of them is about 50% of all business owners are baby boomers and are expecting to transition partially or fully out of their businesses, so there's obviously a keen interest there. But secondarily, as you know, Richard, the lifetime exclusion, which ramped up to permanent this year of 10.5 million, reduces the number of affluent families manyfold. And as a result of that, there's going to be a need to rethink the type of services that the trust and estate attorneys would otherwise provide. Otherwise, they're going to be the way of the dodo bird.
Yeah, I was criticized for stating in public recently that there are now more, well, professionals in this country doing estate planning than there are families that actually need estate planning.
It's an accurate statement, however.
I think it is accurate. But there are a few people who took offense to it because I think they didn't know the numbers. You know the numbers, right? I mean, how many families in this country have net worth of more than 10? If you don't know, I know the answer. But how many families have a net worth of more than 10 million?
Well, there's roughly a number of different, in the United States, there's different estimates there. But the one that I think the Census Bureau has is 200,000 families, or a total of 700,000 individuals. And that's a high number, I would argue. Mm-hmm. But I'm very comfortable on the 200,000.
Yeah, that's all. And then what percentage of those are over 25 million, for example?
It drops considerably to approximately a tenth of that.
Right, about a tenth of that. Yet there are, well, about 1.5 million attorneys in the country. And if you look at the phone book suggests about 20 or 25% of them say they do estate planning. And there's other people who do estate planning. There's wealth advisors who do estate planning and life insurance specialists who do estate planning and a few CPAs who do estate planning. So I think anybody who does estate planning, if you have one family worth more than $25 million, you actually have more than your share.
Hey, we should talk about dabbling by the CPAs if there's time. We should.
Oh, we're going to, but I want to do that later. Okay. I want to do that later because, so anyway, you may have gotten the same effect on Friday. I do a lot of public speaking too, and when I say these things in rooms of attorneys and CPAs, I get a lot of blank looks. Like, you mean my? I don't have anything to do anymore? And I think what's happened is I think a lot of estate planning attorneys haven't quite seen it yet because everybody was really busy at the end of last year because we didn't know if we were going to have that 5.12 million exemption become permanent or not permanent or 10.25 per couple. Nobody knew. So there was a lot of gifting done at the end of the year. So everybody was really busy. And then because a lot of gifting was done at the end of the year, we have to file a lot of gift tax returns by April 15th of this year. So everybody's really busy in the first quarter of this year because of all the gift tax returns they have to be filed. But my question, Carl, is what are we all going to do next after we've gotten all our gift tax returns done?
Well, it's a great question. And I think that, and as you probably know, I'm really big on strategy as opposed to reacting to the marketplace because, unfortunately, those that react tend to be the ones that are following the herd. I think what we're going to see is that dwindling, that real effect, we probably won't see until about a year from now. And I say that because, as you know, a lot of these gifts are going to be put on an extension because they can't meet the filing deadline. And technically, I guess you have until October 15th
right,
to take
October
advantage.
15th, yeah.
And so there's going to be a lot of people that have gotten fat off the cow, so to speak, and they'll have a little bit of padding, but they'll notice that there is a decline in the amount of volume of calls coming in for the traditional services. So as somebody that tends to watch human nature, I think we're going to start seeing people say, okay, what am I supposed to do about a year from now when they're realizing that they're back to square one, kind of like 2010?
Yeah, because here's the thing. If your net worth is under $10 million and you're married, you probably don't need to do anything overly sophisticated other than maybe make sure you've got your living trust and all your basic documents buttoned down. If you're worth, say, between $10 and $20 or $25 million, your estate tax would be, well, depending on how much above $10 million you are, you know, $1, $2, $3, $4, $5 million. In most cases, you can solve that liquidity issue with some very simple life insurance planning. So you still don't need to get too creative in that range of net worth. But I like your comment, Carl, that many of these clients own businesses that are maybe the most valuable asset that they own. And they've sort of been conditioned by their advisors to think about depressing the value of their business to avoid estate tax when they really should be thinking otherwise?
Correct. In this particular case, and the beauty here is it really doesn't make a difference of whether the owner is ultra affluent or perhaps have grown the business to, say, $3 million, which I think most of us would agree is still a nice chunk of change. But at the end of the day, when they start talking to some of their various financial planners, they realize that's not as large as they thought it would be after all of the tax considerations and, of course, health influence on health-related needs. So then there's the conversation, gee, I was really hoping that the business would be worth $10 million. Well, you don't create value based on hope. You create value based on actions, and that requires the involvement of certain advisors that know how to enhance value.
And that's what you do.
Correct. And what we usually try to point out, it's not even just looking at the financials because the CPA might look at the balance sheet and the income statement and say, well, we could take a look at their earnings and see if we can't increase their earnings. And I'd say, well, where do you find relationships on that financial statement? And of course, the answer is nowhere. So those are the relationships with the employees. Is there any employee that's representing 60% of the sales? Is there any kind of golden handcuffs for that employee? Is there key life insurance for officers? I can go on.
Hey, we're going to come back and cover those points, Carl, right after these announcements. Stay tuned. All right, we're back with more of It's Your Money and Your Life with Carl Sheeler of Business Valuations Limited and Richard Musio, our main man here at It's Your Money and Your Life. Take it away, gents.
So, Carl, about 2 weeks ago, I got a phone call from a CPA in Arizona. And the CPA in Arizona has a client and I'm not going to be really precise about anything other than where this call came from. CPA has a client that's been with the CPA firm for about 30 years, and the CPA's been, well, doing this for about 30 years, and that client's grown into the biggest client of their CPA firm, and I won't talk about the industry they're in because I want to make sure I don't violate any privacy. Maybe I shouldn't even said where they were from. And the CPA said, I want to talk to you about maybe assisting with some succession planning, because the biggest client of my CPA firm, you know, largest in terms of fees, most significant to their practice, he said, they have a very successful business, and now it's time to move the business to 5 or 6 children or in-laws who are now active in the business, because dad's getting up there in years. And he said, the business, and I'm going to understate the numbers. He said, the business has EBITDA of $20 million. EBITDA, for those of you who don't know, is earnings before income taxes, depreciation, and amortization. So in other words, it's cash flowing about $20 million a year. And he said, and so the business is worth $100 million. And I was wondering if you could maybe help me with this project. And so I started asking questions. And my first question was, how recent is the appraisal or business valuation that you got for the business to confirm that it's worth approximately $100 million? And the CPA said, well, do you want to guess what the CPA said?
Well, I'm really familiar with this industry, and we usually use a rule of thumb about 5x EBITDA.
He wasn't even that precise in his explanation. He said, we don't have a valuation. It just, my client said it's worth 5x what it's making. And I'm thinking,
very analytical.
Oh, and some of the kids in the family aren't in the business. Some are in the business and some aren't in the business. And I'm thinking, there's going to be a lot of people in the litigation community making a lot of money off this guy down the road, because...
Oh, boy.
Is this an aberration?
Yeah, well, we talked about this before. As you probably know, the code of conduct by the AICPA, which is the regulatory body for the CPAs other than the state licensing, has something that deals specifically with competency issue. It's called dabbling. And dabbling is the idea that you do something infrequently, but it is somewhat fogged by the fact that you're a CPA, so the client perceives that, well, since you said this, you must know this to be so. So here, the first thing is that when you have a $20 million EBITDA, the second question I have is, well, how much of that is of the I, which is interest, is associated with debt? Because we're valuing equity. So even if we, for the sake of argument, we say that it was 5x EBITDA gives you $100 million, that might be the value of the company, but it's not the value of the equity.
Well, yeah, the first point you're making is we don't even know that EBITDA is $20 million.
Correct.
It may not be, because there may be debt, there may not be debt. The equipment may be so obsolete that there is no depreciation, but they should be reserving something for future improvement. I mean, there's all kinds of things that could affect what EBITDA truly is, right?
So there would be adjustments to what you were mentioning before about the cash flow to actually work out what true free cash flow is, and if there is a need for making some major capital expenditures for the next few years, then obviously it would be less than $20 million. But conversely, if the officers were, it depends also how they're structured as an organization, but it also would have a great deal to do with some of the perks that are being received by key individuals, whether they're above market norms, they might be adjusted so that actually it might be closer to 25 million in EBITDA, not 20. So there's a lot of moving parts.
Right, and apparently the family owns the real estate on which the business is being operated, but it's not in the business. It's like in an LLC, so the business is paying rent.
Correct.
To the FAP. So that may be above market, below market, who knows?
Correct. So you'd have to make an adjustment on that as well to make sure that it's at arm's length.
Right. So, but let me get to my next point. So let's assume EBITDA really is $20 million. Let's assume that the CPA had that pegged, which I know he didn't, but let's assume he did. So he's saying that we're going to base our planning on the fact that everybody assumes that the business is worth $100 million. Well, in your experience, if you have a company with an EBITDA of $20 million, what's the range of value that you might expect from the minimum to the maximum, without regard to what industry this is in and all these other factors that we talked about?
I think it's a great question. If you have a familiarity with the private capital markets, the moment that you're into that $20 million range, you're going to have some major players that are looking at a synergistic acquisition. What that basically means that it could be another company that's larger that wants to acquire that existing company. It could be a private equity group. It's unlikely to be the existing management that would be making this purchase. And candidly, again, without knowing the industry, I have to make some kind of caveats here. But if you told me that the multiples were somewhere in the 6 to 12 range, I wouldn't be shocked in the least.
Yeah, but here's the thing. So in this situation, everybody's sort of assuming that you have a business worth $100 million that you're going to do planning for to get the business to the next generation. Well, based on my experience, Carl, and again, depending on industry and a bunch of other factors, a business with $20 million of EBITDA, depending on the risk inherent in earning that $20 million, it could be worth anywhere from $60 million to maybe $250 million,
I agree.
Depending on many, many different factors.
I agree.
So let's assume that you do all this planning based on a value of $100,000 because nobody wants to really, you know, do what they're supposed to do it right. And the business turns out to be worth either only 60 or it turns out to be worth 200. I mean, isn't there a lot that can go wrong?
Yes. You'll see me when I'm wearing that other hat called the designated expert, because at that point, your E&O and insurance wouldn't cover that type of gross understatement or overstatement of value.
Right.
Yeah, your point's very well taken. For example, if it was $20 million a year and it was as a result of federal contracts that were coming to an end, that was the last time you're ever going to see that mm-hmm. kind of money being received again. So somebody that's a federal contractor, unless they can demonstrate that there's diversification of where their income and revenues are coming from, it's highly unlikely that you'd see a very high multiple.
Hey, with that thought right there, Carl, let's take a pause. We'll come right back with more of It's Your Money and Your Life after these announcements. Hang on. All right, we're back with the second half of It's Your Money and Your Life, and now over to Richard to thank all of our terrific sponsors.
Thank you. Oh, wait, I'll say more. And our sponsors are...
That's what
I came for. Yeah, exactly. Hey, I've heard your ads running during the show, Carl, okay? Anyway, UBS with Mr. Michael Courant and Drew Freitas. Barron's top 1,000 in the country and top 100 in California. Only firm recognized in San Diego. So quite an accomplishment. Jason Kruger with Signature Analytics, the best CFO business here in town. Our favorite cost segregation expert, Joel Grushkin, with cost segregation initiatives, helping real estate owners improve their cash flow. Rich Gaines, estate planning attorney with Family Legacy Legal. Rich already gets all this stuff that we're talking about. That's why you should call him. Buried in the mist of tax season, Polito Epic CPAs, Don Epic CPA and Paul Polito CPA. You guys, I was just reviewing how you're doing it in our basketball pool. Do not give up your day job. Of course, Carl Sheeler with Business Valuations Limited and the best business bank in Southern California, Regents Bank with Sean Puckett, Steve Sefton with Regents Bank. Thank you to all of our sponsors. And Joe, how can our listeners find out more about our sponsors?
Well, if you just fire up your computer or PDA, you can go to iymoney.com, click on sponsors, all of their contact information, all their biographical information, all of their phone numbers, emails, anything you need is there, and they're all great, and they're all personal friends, and you work with all these people, Richard. They're not just, we don't just take anybody here to be our sponsors, correct?
They're the best of the best, you know, like top 100 barons in California kind of best.
Absolutely.
Like UBS. So, also there'll be some neat stuff coming up on the website later this week. I was quoted last week in Accounting Today, the accounting magazine for accountants. I don't think any accountants read it this time of the year, but be that as it may, there I was. Carl, so we were talking about this big client down in Arizona who's never done a valuation, and the CPA thinks the business is worth $100 million. And obviously, the main one reason why the CPA should encourage the client to get some solid valuation work done, just hire you, is to actually know what the real number they're working with is. But isn't there another reason that would be self-serving that would benefit the CPA to do this?
Oh, absolutely. Not just the CPA, but all the trusted advisors that the CPA would work with. I mean, if you establish a benchmark for the value after you determine what it is that you want to do with wealth, whether you want a partial or full liquidity event, which is just a nice way of saying, are you going to sell the whole company or perhaps just transfer and get part of the equity? Then you get all the other trusted advisors that can actually help maximize the outcome. So it could be the trust and estate attorney. It could be a transaction attorney. It might be somebody in the life insurance space or the commercial banking space, depending on exactly what it is that they want to do and how much more time and effort the founder of that business is interested in amplifying the performance of the business.
Right, but the challenge in the CPA profession is most of us are trained to just look at history. We do tax returns and financial statements, and we never take that baseline or that historical data and project it forward, measure the risk inherent in how a company is actually earning its profits, how to improve those profits, how to reduce the risk or some of the key risk metrics that drive the profits and so on. I think though that savvy consumers, particularly very successful families, are expecting more out of their CPAs and attorneys. So I was having a funny conversation with an estate planning attorney about a month ago, and he was lamenting the fact that now that the exemption equivalent is over $10 million for a couple, he's not going to have any work to do. I don't think he showed up though at your seminar on Friday. And I said, gee whiz, if you just did three things, you'd be busy for the next 5 years. Those three things are, if you looked at all the prior gifting you had clients do back in the late 90s and early 2000s when the exemption was only either $600,000 or $1 million, I said, a lot of those clients have buyer's remorse now. I said, you could do so much work fixing those problems. I also made the point that about 90% of the life insurance that's owned for estate planning reasons is now not really serving the objective that it was designed for, which was to pay estate tax, because there is no estate tax because the exemption has gone up so much. And then I also pointed out that probably 90% of the living trusts that are drafted that are out there are going to, now that we have over $10 million of exemption for married couples, have really bizarre funding results if they are followed literally, and they should probably be updated to incorporate what happened here at the end of the year with the fiscal cliff legislation. Do you have any comment on that thought?
Yeah, I'd like to actually weigh in on that. All this would also be applicable to families of wealth with real property holdings. I gave what I thought was at least half a dozen specific takeaway items that the trusted advisors, in this case mostly trust and estate attorneys, could do. For example, they could go back to all the bylaws, the operating agreements, the buy-sell agreements, and update and amend them, because that is also risk as well. If you have a buy-sell agreement, 90%, as you know, are never funded with insurance, mm-hmm. that's risk. If they take a look at the operating agreement, and one of the things that you know with the asset holding companies, most of them don't have an investment policy statements. And the reason that we recommend that the attorney does that is that there's something called the Section 2036, which is a safe harbor rule, that you have to be able to demonstrate that the reason that the transaction occurred was other than just tax avoidance. And as I'm sure you're well aware of, most of these transactions occurred towards the end of the year. And if you don't have an investment policy statement that says, here was the expectation of the family to receive this level of return, to hold on to this asset for this length of time, which could be for decades, that would be a great way to minimize the likelihood that the service would prevail on the issue of whether this was just a means to avoid taxes.
Yeah, I think the timing was somewhat curious that everybody waited until the last minute, but most people behave that way. I was telling people, do the planning a year or two before the expected sunset at the end of 2012, because it would strengthen whatever arguments you have about the business purpose behind the planning you're doing. Right. Not I was worried that the state tax exemption was going to drop tomorrow on January 1st compared to today on December 31st. But when you did the work on December 31st or signed the documents, it suggests that tax avoidance was probably the only thing you were really thinking about, even though you might have good stories that you've documented the file with. Very interesting how I think a lot of professionals, they're worried about what they're going to be doing next, but they haven't really looked backwards at all the things that have been done that were done in a context that's much different than the present context that we're sitting in with over $10 million of exemptions. Because, for example, I run into families all the time who did family limited partnerships in the 1990s when the exemption was only $600,000 per spouse. And they might be only worth only $3 or $4 million. Not to say that $3 or $4 million should be prefaced by the word only. That's still a very good accomplishment to generate that kind of net worth in your lifetime. But the point is, if those families had a crystal ball, they never would have done that planning 15 years ago. It's totally unnecessary now, at least as far as an estate tax avoidance device goes. It may have been good planning from an asset protection standpoint or from a business succession planning standpoint, But the estate tax savings is, no longer exists. Also, there's a lot of $1 and $2 and $3 and $4 and $5 million life insurance policies out there that were designed to pay estate tax when somebody died, where there now is no estate tax. Now, you may want to still keep that life insurance. We'll see. Depends on everybody's particular facts and circumstances. So, Carl, you wrote some really interesting short articles about valuation that has a great title. The title is CPAs Dabbling in Russian Roulette with Five Bullets. You've sort of touched on this, but touch on it some more, would you please?
Sure. What I did is I actually gave some concrete examples over a series of four-part essay, each being a page in length, that I talk about situations that I have personally been made aware of, which is usually when we're brought in after somebody has paid for a very expensive paperweight, which is our kind of our way of saying that the valuation didn't accomplish what it was supposed to because it was found to be wanting, shall we say. But the bottom line goes back to what I was mentioning to you before about the concept of dabbling, that in the best circumstances, you had the right value, but it wasn't supported. In the worst case circumstances, it was so egregious as to be facing penalties, sometimes even criminal action, as a result of what might be considered as malfeasance. There's a section in the IRS code about 666, interesting, the first three numbers are six, seven, where it's a gross over or under valuation. Not only is there penalties and interest, but the fines can be, I think, 150% of the
150%
actual tax
of the amount
owed. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's serious.
Yeah. It's serious business. So there's an interesting estate planning seminar coming up that the YMCA puts on. We love the YMCA, but it had some interesting subject matters that apparently are going to be presented as follows. Client demographics will inform changes in everyday estate planning. Client needs will inform changes in practice itself. Changes in the economics of the practice will affect those who do estate planning. And changes in the demographics of planners themselves, that means that a lot of the planners are really old, will affect who we hire and how we train them. Are you going to this thing next? It's in May.
Actually, I was part of the planning committee for the Y and had a little bit to say about what the topics ought to be. And yes, absolutely. I think not only are we seeing a transitioning of the clients that would be receiving the services and their demographics, but also those individuals that are providing the services. And one of the things that I think is a powerful statement that we didn't even talk about is 70% of the second generation after that wealth changes hands will be firing their existing advisors that mom and dad used.
Hmm. Yeah, 70% of CPAs, attorneys, wealth advisors, etc.
All right. Well, we've got to take a little break right now, though, Richard. And Carl will come right back with more of It's Your Money and Your Life right after this. It's Your Money, Your Life, and Your Legacy. And we're back with Richard and Carl in the last segment. Take it away.
Wow, time flies when you're having so much fun.
Mm-hmm.
But I love business valuation. The reason I love it is because it's probably the most important thing that business owners can do at the start of some sort of sequence or series of events that they never do at the start. They always wait until the end, if ever. And to me, it's the thing that can really drive the value of a business much, much higher if you address it early, well before, for example, when you plan to sell the business, or well before when you plan to get the business in the kids' hands.
And Richard, how could there be such a discrepancy over valuation? I mean, you're telling me a business is $100 million, but it could be worth $200 million.
The reason, Joe, is because there's not a good understanding of what really drives value. Most CPAs think, most business owners think, what drives value is how much profits the business is making.
Mm-hmm.
But that, of course, you need to have, and some businesses that don't even have profits yet have great value. We've seen that mm-hmm. in certain industries. But what really drives a business's value more so, well, it's equally important, the risk inherent in earning those profits.
Mm.
Whether it's a lot of risk that's being taken to do that or very little risk that's being taken to do that. Carl, can you tell us how risk and the multiple that we apply to cash flow is, those are really the same words?
It really is when you simplify it. If you just think about it this way, if you could reduce risk in anything, such as playing blackjack, to up your odds, would you win more often? The answer would be, of course you would. If you have an operating business and you start thinking it in terms not just of how much profit it has, but how do I reduce the risk, the lower the risk, the higher the multiple, the higher the multiple, the higher the value. So if you know those specific items that are causing the business to have higher risk and you work on those become the priority items, those items that you can handle in-house, that you take care of if you need outsourced assistance, whether it be from a trusted advisor or specialist. Usually the return on the investment as far as what you'd pay those people to do what they specialize in, it is so high. And literally, I've given several examples in more recent presentations where it's 50x, and I just make it simple statement. I say, for every dollar you give me, I give you $50 back. When would you want to stop doing that? And most people say, well, never, of course. So I said, okay, for the next 18 months, that's exactly what we're going to do for you. For every dollar you give us in expert fees, what you're going to get back is 50x. Is that a plan that you're willing to stick with? And we hope that the client would say yes, because of course, if they say no, there's not much you can really do.
No, so you can't help people who don't want to help themselves. So if you have a very successful, closely held business and you're looking to improve the value, reduce the risk, you definitely want to track Carl down. You really, really do. But let me give you a simple example as to how risk works. Let's assume we have two businesses in the same industry, both been in the business the same amount of years, and they both have the same top line and bottom line revenue. They both have $50 million of sales, and they both make $10 million. Well, a lot of CPAs who dabble would come up with a valuation that is the same for those two companies because they just plug the historical numbers in, and that's what the computer program does. But let's assume the one business with $50 million of sales has two customers. One customer pays it $30 million a year, and the other customer pays it $20 million a year, whereas the other business with $50 million of sales has, I don't know, 500,000 customers paying $1,000 or $10,000 a year, whatever the math is. Would you get a different value, Carl?
Of course. What you're talking about is concentration of risk, in this case, concentration of clients. So the fact that you only have two clients is going to cause the risk to be actually considerably
higher.
Yes.
Right, because the
you lose one, you might lose 60% of your business.
Right. Whereas if you've got 5,000 clients and you lose your biggest one, you're still doing 99.2% of what you were doing to begin with. You don't even necessarily notice it.
Correct.
That's risk. Carl, a very interesting saying, shirt sleeves to shirt sleeves in three generations. What on earth does that mean?
Actually, and it's kind of interesting because there's several different nationalities which has a very similar concept. So we love business owners because they contribute to over 60% of the GDP in the United States, the family businesses. So it's our goal to make sure that they're successful. Sadly, what ends up happening is the founder that understands risk and the commitment to the business has not always endowed the next beneficiaries to that same concept of being invested in the business. So it's not unusual for the second generation family members, once mom and dad pass, that they sell off the business, have the net proceeds. It's usually what's referred to as a fire sale because they don't even get full value for it because they just want the cash. And now that they have cash, not unlike winning the lottery, most lottery winners become destitute within 3 years.
Right, because they spend it on, well, Lear jets and frequent trips to Aspen and all that other fun stuff.
And more lottery tickets.
So by the time that their kids are old enough, their kids are back to the same boat that the original founder was when they first started the business.
Right, so get out and start making money all over again. But it's an interesting phenomenon. Certainly with regard to understanding value, I would agree with your assessment that in many cases, when businesses get sold, they get sold for much less than they should have been sold for just because the seller wants to get cash and never really understood how to drive value higher.
May I give a specific example?
We've got about a minute and a half, so okay, perfect timing.
So here what you would have is a business that, let's say, is worth $20 million. Instead of selling the whole business, they decide that they're going to sell off a 30% piece. And let's say, for the sake of argument, that everybody agrees that it's $5 million because they don't have control with the 30%, and that private equity group takes a minority interest, but they have all the skills and the tools that helps the existing founder to amp up the business. So in 3 years, it's not a $20 million business, but it's a $100 million business, of which they still have the 70% interest in. That's a nice little return on investment that most people wouldn't even have been aware of.
Yeah, usually it's discussed in the context of either keep it or sell it. It's that simple.
There you go.
And hey, that's overly simple.
Well, we've got to wrap it right there. But, Carl, thanks for your great information being our guest tonight. And we appreciate your sponsorship of our show. And we hope you can back again soon.
With pleasure.
Richard, you have a great week.
You too, Joe.
And if you need to get a hold of Carl, it's bizvalsltd.com. And now I'd like to thank Justin Hart, our board operator at Extraordinaire, our account executive, Craig Blanke, our programming genius, Dave Sniff. And you have a great week. We'll see you all next week with Frank Camparino talking about franchises. Take care now. Good night.